stood and pointed at the spot. The EOD team took control of the area and sent Timothy, Ruckley, Boyd, and Wong back a safe distance. Outside the park, groups of soldiers stood guard, watching for any threats. "What the hell were those things doing here last night?" Timothy muttered. "Scouting our defenses, probably," Ruckley said. "Or maybe on their way back from doing that," Wong said. "You think they were already watching Houston?" Timothy asked. "Do they know what we're doing in Galveston?" "Relax," Ruckley said. She patted him on the back. "Captain Beckham will figure out what they're planning." The EOD team backed away from the mine that Wong had found, clearing a wide enough space to detonate it safely. One of the men shouted, "Fire in the hole!" Another loud bang tossed a cloud of dirt into the air. The smell of hot metal drifted from the blast site. "Clear," said the same soldier. "You heard him," Ruckley said. "Get to work." Wong picked up the metal detector again and started surveying the area where they had left off. The work was slow going and tedious, and Timothy almost resented the effort. He would rather be out on patrol, searching for new signs of chimeras or collaborators. Ruckley was right. There would be more. "Something else is bothering me," Timothy said. "Why would they send chimeras? Why not just a group of collaborators?" "I think you and I both know why," she answered. "They're closing in for the final blow." Ruckley confirmed the guess with a nod. The new guards were constantly ahead of them. The metal detector went off again, and Timothy halted. "What is this?" Wong asked. He handed the detector off to Boyd again before dropping to a crouch. Timothy looked over his shoulder at a metal cylinder nestled in the grass. "Looks like a smoke grenade," Boyd said. "That ain't a smoke grenade," Ruckley said. Timothy noticed their position was 10 yards from the picnic shelter where they had first seen the Chimera scouts camped out. Boyd called over the EOD team. One of the techs squinted at it, stroking his graying beard. "Know what it is?" Wong asked. The man stared, then gestured for everyone to move back. "I think it's some sort of gas grenade." "So what?" Boyd asked. "Tear gas isn't the worst thing in the world." "We don't know what's in that grenade," Ruckley said. "Could be tear gas, but we've never seen these monsters use non-lethal weapons. For all we know, it could be some kind of chemical agent they plan to lob into a base." Timothy shuddered. "After what we saw in Mount Katahdin, I bet you're right." Ruckley squinted at the canister. "Maybe it contains a bioweapon, an engineered disease, God only knows." "Now I hope it's just tear gas," Wong said. "You guys are freaking me out." "Whatever it is, if the new gods sent chimeras to deliver them, it's gotta be bad," Timothy said. Boyd whistled. "Real fucking bad." "Get it secured," Ruckley ordered. "We need to get this back to the science team." 7. By the time teams Ghost and Spearhead returned to base, Banff was already in a state of chaos. Late morning light bled through the dense cloud cover over the Fairmont Banff Springs Hotel. Dohai ran toward the first steel panel gate outside the hotel. Razor wire spanned the walls, interspersed with wooden guard towers where snipers and machine gunners lay in wait. Guns pointed at them from the men along the walls.
"Spearhead and Ghost requesting entry," Nielsen shouted into the radio.
The gate blocking the road to the hotel began to shift, snow shedding from the groaning metal. The teams ran inside, and the soldiers manning the gate quickly replaced it, shouting orders to take firing positions along the wall. Inside the base, soldiers were already preparing snowmobiles and large transport trucks for what appeared to be a potential evacuation. A man shoved through the heavy snow toward them. Dohai recognized him as Sergeant Prince, the man who had first welcomed him and Team Ghost to Banff.
"Nielsen, get up on those walls," Prince shouted. "Ghost, we need you inside."
Dohai ran with Prince, Fitz, and Ace past the hotel toward a warehouse-like garage. Inside it, civilians were being loaded up into a bus and a pair of trucks as officers directed soldiers into snowplows.
"Are we fighting or retreating?" Fitz shouted over the din.
"Both," Prince said. "Kamer will explain."
They went to a dark corner of the garage past stacks of crates and supplies that hadn't yet made it onto the trucks. Kamer stood next to a group of four officers and a few soldiers hidden from the civilians, but several children had come over to look at their prisoner. Corin was on the ground, limbs bound by chains, body trembling, blood wet from wounds across his flesh. Kamer continued barking orders.
"What the hell did you do to our prisoner?" Ace asked, interrupting him.
"What you failed to do," Kamer said, turning slightly. "But this asshole is full of lies." Corin spat a glob of blood on the concrete. When the red saliva hit, one of his fanged teeth fell out.
"I told you, I hate the new gods as much as you do. They gave me this body. They threatened my family."
"Bullshit," Kamer said. "Your friends came for you."
"We don't know that," Fitz said. "He's worth more to us alive than dead, General."
"I disagree," Kamer said, pulling out his sidearm. Ace's cheeks flushed scarlet as he stepped protectively between Kamer and Corin.
"I, for one, believe him, and I'm not gonna let you kill him."
"You believe this monster?" Kamer flitted the barrel of his pistol toward Corin. "This freak of nature?"
"I do," Ace said. "He could have given us up in Seattle. Probably would have been rewarded for it. Instead, he got us out of that hellhole. He brought this attack on."
"Sir, we need to move the civilians," an officer said. "The enemy is getting too close."
"Fine," Kamer said. "Tell the drivers to go out the back."
The pop of small arms fire echoed outside the garage. Dohai instinctively lifted his rifle, waiting for more. Distant shouting and a few voices crackled over the radios of the officers, but the gunfire waned.
"He might have more intel we can use," Dohai said. "For that matter, we might be able to use him as a spy."
"He probably is a damn spy," Kamer yelled. "You spent a little time guarding this thing, and he's already corrupted your minds."
"I could help you fight," Corin said, glaring up at Kamer.
"Right," Kamer snorted. "If this beast didn't draw the enemy here, then who did?"
Dohai tried to come up with an answer, but the truth was he didn't know.
"The only logical answer is Corin," Kamer said.
The rattle of gunfire sounded again, this time longer. Cries came from the buses already packed full of civilians, and the people waiting to board dropped low, covering their heads or huddling with loved ones.
"With respect, sir, right now it doesn't matter," Fitz said. "What matters is we fight back."
"That's exactly what we're doing out there," Kamer said. "Fighting and dying, all because this piece of shit brought the enemy to our doorstep." A loud boom echoed outside. This time, when the gunfire started, it didn't stop. Frightened screams rang out, followed by the shouts of soldiers directing people into the transport vehicles. At the back of the garage, a single big door opened, and the first bus rumbled to life. One of the soldiers held his radio to his ear.
"General, they're at the gates."
Kamer lowered his pistol.
"Sergeant Prince, evacuate all of the civilians now."
At the beginning of the war, Dohai would have thought Kamer's choice was foolish, that sending their civilians fleeing just as an attack set in was too rash, too reactive. However, he had seen what the collaborators and variants did to all those left behind when they conquered a base. The snowplows and buses revved their engines, leaving the back of the garage one at a time. Kamer lowered his pistol and shook his head at Corin.
"You've doomed us."
Ace backed away, and Dohai stepped up to Fitz.
"Go with the evacuees," Kamer said. "There are a couple of trucks waiting outside behind the garage. I promised your president I'd get you back to the Allied States, and I intend to do just that."
Shouting sounded outside, but a blast silenced the voices. A current of loud booms rumbled the ground, the unmistakable sound of grenades. One of the comms officers turned toward Kamer and Ghost.
"They've breached the gates."
"Prioritize defense of the convoys," Kamer said, "and get the hell out of here. Ghost, take that animal with you if you want it so bad."
The bark of gunfire sounded somewhere just outside the garage. Dohai shouldered his rifle. He started to back up with the team toward the exit as the roar of a bear sounded outside. A dent the size of a tire appeared in the two metal doors. Then, claws ripped through. The beast on the other side pried the massive garage doors apart
until a monstrous face appeared. The white fur around its yellow eyes was covered in blood, and it snarled, baring fangs each the size of a long knife. It let out a roar that hurt Dohai's ears, but he held his stance, firing a burst of armor-piercing rounds into its nose, eyes, and skull. The monster slumped to the floor, halfway through the gap in the doors. Four collaborators climbed over it, firing wildly into the room. Kamer ducked, but one of his officers was too slow. Rounds riddled his body and sent him sprawling over the floor.
"Free me," Corin growled. "I'll help."
Ace and Fitz exchanged a glance, and Fitz nodded.
"What? Hell no," said the Canadian soldier guarding Corin. "We can't trust—"
A bullet punched through his throat and he slumped over, gripping his neck. More collaborators climbed over the dead bear. Ace sent a torrent of fire their way while Dohai moved toward Corin.
"Cover me," he shouted.
Another collaborator with an M249 made it into the garage, the heavy gunfire echoing in the enclosed space.
"Don't make me regret this," Dohai said to Corin.
He picked up the keys and unlocked the chains.
"I won't forget what you've done," replied the Chimera.
For a moment, Dohai feared there was a terrible threat veiled behind those words. Bullets slammed into crates around him, not giving him a chance to think. The last of the vehicles screeched out of the back of the garage.
"Cover them!" Fitz yelled.
Kamer and his soldiers fired from behind leftover crates to give the civilians a chance to escape.
"I'm out," Ace said.
Dohai tossed him a magazine, then covered him, firing at the collaborators who had stormed the garage. Corin hunched down next to Dohai, watching with his golden eyes like a predator waiting to make a move. Behind the collaborators came another shape, this one a hulking figure wearing a frayed cloak. It kept to the shadows, but Dohai didn't need to see the face or features to know it was an alpha.
"General," Corin said, his voice dripping with fear.
Not just any alpha, Dohai realized. This was the brute that had nearly killed Beckham, Horn, and Rico at Mount Katahdin. Dohai switched on his tack light and directed it at the monster. The beam hit it in the face, and Dohai pulled the trigger as the creature opened its crocodile-like maw to let out a shriek. The beast was so fast only one of the three bullets thunked into its meaty flesh. The bolt of Dohai's rifle locked back a moment later. He was completely out of ammunition. A torrent of fire forced Dohai back down, bullets punching into the crates and walls. He pulled out his M9 and looked over his shoulder to see Kamer had fallen. Corin rushed to where the Canadian general had fallen.
"No, Corin!" Ace yelled.
Corin grabbed the limp general, dragging him out of view. Dohai had to turn back and fire on two collaborators charging his position. The variant general was out of sight, flanking to pick them off one at a time. Everything had turned to shit in a matter of seconds. Dohai had made a mistake letting Corin out of his locks, and the Alpha was preparing to tear them all apart with the collaborator soldiers. Time seemed to slow as rounds slammed into the crate and whizzed past Dohai. Turning, he saw Corin standing now with fresh blood on his chest. No doubt the blood of Kamer. The Chimera raised the rifle and aimed it right at Dohai. He had known for a long time he would die in battle, but not because of a stupid mistake like this. He watched the muzzle flare and bullets lance overhead, but none of them pounded his body. He glanced around the crate to see two collaborators thump against the ground. A roar sounded from the variant general. He exploded through a wall of crates and pounded into Corin, knocking the Chimera to the ground. Dohai looked over to see Kamer was sprawled out behind the busted crates where Corin had dragged him to safety. Ace ran to him and lifted the general into a fireman's carry, running toward the back of the garage.
"Come on," Ace yelled to Dohai.
Dohai watched Corin struggling against the larger alpha.
"Damn it," he thought.
He couldn't leave Corin to die like this. He aimed his pistol, waiting for a shot. More collaborators stormed in the garage. Pulling the trigger, Dohai put a round in the general. The giant beast reared back, and he put another two into the chest. Corin pushed himself up and ran over to Dohai as the Alpha limped away in retreat. Together, the Chimera and Dohai ran to catch up with the rest of the team outside the garage.
Behind them, the glow of bright orange spheres of fire lit up the sky. The hotel was burning. The snow was coming down heavily again, nearly blotting out their vision, despite the light seeping through the gray clouds. Behind the screen of snow, he saw two big trucks with snowplows fixed to the front, idling at an open gate.
Thank you, Father Sky, Dohai thought. The cover the snow provided might be what saved them today.
Dohai swung his rifle up at shapes approaching from behind the trucks. But they weren't hulking bears, nor did they wear the ragged white and gray clothing of the collaborators. It was Nielsen and the rest of Spearhead with Sergeant Prince.
Get in,
Nielsen said, motioning to the closest truck. They all piled into the back, hunching down against the freezing metal. Ace lowered Kamer gently onto the truck bed. The man was unconscious, but alive. Dohai looked out the back of the vehicle at a monstrous shape silhouetted against the fires.
The General.
The monstrous variant stood his ground, watching as the truck took off.
What the hell was that thing?
Nielsen asked.
An Alpha, Fitz said. The General, Corrin said. Leader of the New God armies.
The group fell into silence as the truck raced away for safety far from the base. Toussaint broke the quiet.
Is this what it's like?
What?
Ace asked.
The attacks, the monsters, out of nowhere.
Fitz nodded.
Almost always, there's little warning. And most of the time it's a slaughter, Ace added.
Good God, Toussaint said.
I'm sorry, Prince said. We had no idea.
No more, Nielsen said. We're in this fight now.
Where are we headed? Fitz asked.
Calgary, Prince said. We'll regroup there. Dohai took in a deep breath. He couldn't help but feel Ace was right, and they were heading from one slaughter to another. Beckham knocked on the door to the laboratory. Through a window, he saw Kate working in an isolated chamber. She wore a blue CBRN suit. Yellow biohazard signs hung on the wall near the chamber and above a decon anteroom leading into it. Kate could not hear him through the double set of windows, but her assistant Ron was working in the less restricted BLS-2 portion and noticed him standing there. Ron nodded at Beckham, then went to an intercom connected to the interior of the isolated chamber. Kate turned and waved a gloved hand. She went through the decon process, then carefully removed her suit before finally exiting and meeting him outside the lab.
Sorry, I know I'm late, Kate said. I got wrapped up with work.
Don't worry about it. Beckham held up a paper bag. I brought lunch.
Great, I'm starving. Truth be told, I need some time away from the lab.
They left the hospital and met four soldiers outside who had escorted Beckham there. Together, they walked under the afternoon sun back toward the outpost gate.
You know, the hospital is only a 5-minute walk from the gate, Kate said. I can make it there in broad daylight, especially with the men Commander Jacobs assigned to protect me.
I feel better walking you in myself.
Kate wrapped her arm through his.
And that's why I love you.
Once inside the outpost, Beckham led them to the nearest park. Trees dotted the wide rolling lawns around a long reflection pool leading to a lake. Ducks and geese squawked as they milled about the water, their calls mixing in with the chatter of all the refugees who had recently arrived at Houston. Dozens of tents had been installed around the park to house the newcomers. The soldiers, following Kate and Beckham, watched them with suspicion.
So many people.
Kate's gaze followed a pair of young boys kicking a soccer ball back and forth.
And so many families.
Beckham thought of Javier and Galveston with the girls, hoping they were doing okay.
Maybe we can try and call Connor tonight, Beckham said as they walked. I'm sure he's doing a good job taking care of them, but it would be good to check in.
I'd really like that.
Kate motioned toward a circle of benches under a roof of curving southern live oak branches near the reflection pool.
How about we sit down over there?
Beckham dropped into one of the benches, then spread the bag's contents between them. Their escort of soldiers fanned out, eyeing the refugees.
PB&Js, apples, and a bunch of waters, Kate said. Don't tell me you made it all yourself.
Beckham grinned. As a matter of fact, I did. Hope it's up to your standards. She took the first bite of her sandwich, then looked out over the reflection pool.
We started the analysis on that grenade Timothy's team recovered.
Oh? Kate nodded, swallowing her food.
It appears to be a modified tear gas grenade.
Really? I thought it was some...
That's not all, she interrupted. There wasn't tear gas inside. I've already confirmed it has bacterial components, but we haven't identified what the bacteria is yet.
Good God. Beckham found his appetite was gone.
I'll know more soon.
Beckham forced a bite down. Any other news from the tunnels?
We've been monitoring all the channels, but we're no closer to finding out where the Prophet is.
No indication of any upcoming attacks?
Nothing yet.
Beckham suddenly went still. Kate's eyes flitted to the ground like she was recalling something horrid. He placed his hand on hers.
Are you all right? He asked.
Yeah.
You can tell me.
It's okay. That network. Every time I connect, I hear the voices of all the people attached to the webbing. I can hear the monsters communicating with each other, talking about killing people, ripping them apart. And there's nothing I can do to save them.
Everything we're doing is to save them.
Beckham squeezed her hand. He was glad Leslie had been trained on connecting to the network, too. He could see his wife desperately needed a break from the immense mental toil that integrating with the network must cost her.
Even if we eventually succeed, how many will die?
We'll do our best to save everyone we can, Beckham said.
I know, Kate said. It starts here in this outpost. At least with you and Commander Jacobs on the job, the people here will be safe.
I'm not so sure.
Beckham picked up his apple but stopped shy of eating it.
The first wave of new reinforcements from Canada and Mexico have helped shore a few holes in our defenses, but some of the soldiers they've sent are more inexperienced than the greenhorns who trained with Timothy.
Then you don't think we'll be safe?
She too had stopped eating, and instead stared out at the reflection pool. A few children were chasing ducks with their parents watching.
It's not safe anywhere.
Beckham saw a couple of families in nearby tents looking over at him. They were too far to hear him, but he spoke in a quieter voice all the same.
The gas grenade you analyzed has me worried the enemy will try something different.
You're right, she said, starting to stand. Maybe taking the time for lunch was a mistake. I need to focus on finding out what kind of bacteria was in that grenade.
You still need to eat.
Beckham looked up at her until she slowly sat back down. Again, he looked around, making sure no one was listening in.
I've been working with command to prepare rapid evacuation procedures for all the civilians at the first sign of danger, Beckham said.
You want to abandon Houston?
We have to consider a backup plan in case the reinforcements and defenses don't hold.
Beckham's fingers tightened around his water bottle.
I hate to admit it, but after the news we got about Banff, we can't be caught with our pants down like they were. They barely got civilians out in time, and many didn't make it.
Beckham looked his wife in the eyes.
If the enemy does come, I want you to be on the first truck out of here.
I'm not leaving without you.
You'll have to, Beckham said. You're the brains of the science operation.
He leaned closer.
Most importantly, you're Javier's mother. No matter what happens, he can't lose both of us.
Don't talk like that. He's not going to lose either of us.
Kate, we have to be realistic. We have to consider everything.
Of course we do, but we're not in Canada. We have an advantage they don't have. We're listening to the Collaborator Network. We'll know before the monsters attack.
Beckham started to nod, but realization stabbed through him of something he had missed.
Kate, You and your team never intercepted anything about the scouts around Houston, right?
She shook her head.
And this new grenade weapon? Nothing about it? He asked.
No, unfortunately.
And Banff?
No, but...
Kate trailed off.
That's all the way north. Maybe they didn't communicate about the attack on our network.
Are you sure? Back in New York, you were able to intercept intel on attacks across the country. Why would that have changed now? Kate arched a brow.
Maybe we're doing something wrong. Our communication efforts might not work as well as I thought, or we're cut off from part of their network here in Houston.
Two of the refugee children playing soccer looked at them, pointing at their food. They started to approach Beckham and Kate, but one of the soldiers stepped to block them.
It's okay, Kate said.
The boys were skinny and dirty. She waved them over and gave them the apples she and Beckham had neglected. The boys ran away with the fruit, smiles spreading across their faces.
You and Jacobs are working on a plan B then, Kate said. If the communication intercepts aren't working as well anymore, maybe it's time the science team makes a B plan of our own.
8. President Ringgold walked down the sidewalk next to General Cornelius and Colonel Stillwell. The President's Secret Service agents shadowed them. They passed by the Galveston boardwalk. It stretched off the shore outside the fences and barricades lining the eastern side of the island. Once a popular tourist attraction filled with carnival rides, games, and restaurants, it had long since fallen into neglect. The Ferris wheel hung at a precarious angle, rusted and bent. Ringgold couldn't help but see the symbolism there, comparing it to civilization. But unlike that wheel, civilization still had a chance.
Today is going to be a good day, she said.
I have every confidence that you are right, Madam President, Cornelius said before looking toward Stillwell. The reinforcements from our friends in the north and south will change this war.
Stillwell gave a soft harumph. They continued walking side by side toward the makeshift airfield that had once been Seawall Boulevard to meet their new comrades. Men and women in uniform hurried between buildings and large olive-green canvas tents. Some wore the standard-issue ACUs of the Allied States. Others had black uniforms with the orca patch characteristic of Cornelius's private army. Ringgold twisted her wrist to see her watch.
The planes are a little late, aren't they?
Stillwell shrugged.
I haven't heard anything about delays. Hopefully no news is good news, Cornelius said.
The sun was beginning to set, disappearing beyond the neighborhoods to the west. The distant roar of plane engines sounded to their north. Ringgold turned around and looked toward the fluffy clouds glowing orange in the last pangs of daylight. Silhouetted against them, she saw the outline of three C-130s descending toward Galveston. They flew past the city, curving in formation to make their final approach from the south.
Just three? Cornelius asked, looking toward Stillwell. That can't be more than a few hundred troops.
I thought you said all the troops were coming in tonight, Ringgold said. Is there another scheduled flight we don't know about?
I told you everything I know, Stillwell said.
Ringgold scanned the sky, looking for more planes.
You don't think something happened to the rest of the planes, do you?
We would have heard something on the radio, Cornelius said. A mayday, at the very least.
Ringgold picked up her pace, her heart thudding faster.
They must still be on their way, Stillwell said. Maybe they just staggered their arrivals.
That makes sense, Cornelius said. They would want to throw off any enemy scouts. Ringgold would have to take their word for it. The growl of the first C-130's engines roared as the craft made its final approach. Its wheels touched down with a heavy jolt at the southern end of the airstrip. Ringgold, Cornelius, and Stillwell made it to the guard station at the northern end of the strip. They waited under a wide canvas tent with its sides rolled up so they could watch the plane taxi toward their position. Crew chiefs and soldiers waited around them, ready to tend to the plane and welcome the reinforcements to Galveston. The aircraft marshaler signaled for the plane to stop near the tent.
before anyone stepped off, a group of Marines boarded to ensure the aircraft's passenger manifest was in order and to perform routine security checks. The other two planes started their final approach afterward. As the engines wound down on the first plane, one of the lieutenants in charge of the welcoming operations signaled to Ringgold that the coast was clear. Her Secret Service agents flocked around her, Stillwell, and Cornelius. As her footsteps clicked across the asphalt, the rear ramp of the plane lowered. Ringgold greeted the soldiers as they streamed off the craft. They looked exhausted. That much was expected. But she also saw them hanging their heads low, their shoulders slumped. Ringgold caught one of the soldiers' eyes. He was a younger man, maybe 18 or 19. He stiffened when their gazes crossed, and he readjusted the strap of the rifle over his back. That fraction of a second when their eyes met was more than enough for Ringgold to see something was wrong. They looked defeated, she thought. Ringgold searched the crowd for someone who could tell her what was happening. She spotted 5 men following the troops off. The epaulettes on their shoulders and their stiff stances clearly told her they were in charge. She made a beeline for the officers with Cornelius and Stillwell on her tail. One of the officers turned toward her, stepping away from the group. His head was shaved bald under his green cap, and deep bags hung under sharp blue eyes lined with wrinkles.
"President Ringgold," he said, taking a step toward her. "General Andrew Vance."
Ringgold shook his hand in a tight grip. "General Vance, welcome to the Allied States. We'll see that your men are taken care of. This is General Cornelius. He's in charge of the base here at Galveston, and I presume you already know Colonel Stillwell."
"I trust he's been serving you well," Vance said.
"He has," Ringgold said. The other two C-130s had landed and were now taxiing toward them, preparing to unload. "We were preparing for all 6 planes this morning," she said. "When can we expect the arrival of the other 3? Vance gestured toward the soldiers and Secret Service agents shadowing them as they walked back toward the tent.
"I suggest we discuss this in a quieter, perhaps more private environment."
The trip back to their CIC would be at least a 20-minute drive, and Ringgold didn't want to wait any longer than she had to. She pointed at a nearby coffee house that had since been requisitioned as an office for some of the air traffic personnel. When they entered, the Secret Service agents swept the room, ushering away the 2 officers working at computers on the desks. Cornelius drew the blinds, shutting out the last fingers of light from the sunset, and the room went dark until Ringgold flipped a switch. Vance looked toward the 4 other Canadian officers.
"I think it would be best if we kept this a closed meeting."
Ringgold nodded to her Secret Service agents to wait outside with the other officers and soldiers.
"Madam President, I get the sense you don't like to beat around the bush," Vance started as they took seats around a small table, finally alone.
"I don't," Ringgold said, "especially because we have no time for it." Vance steepled his fingers together. He looked as if he was searching for words.
"There isn't going to be another 3 planes.
"Not tonight?" Cornelius asked.
"Not ever," Vance said.
"Sir, I was told," Stillwell began.
"Madam President, we had every intention to deliver our troops as promised, but after the attack on Banff, I'm afraid we realized that was no longer tenable," Vance said. "We need every man and woman we can spare to defend our own country."
Cornelius started to turn red.
"We've been over this. Trying to survive this onslaught by heading behind walls isn't working."
"The only way we're defeating these monsters is with a concerted offensive strike," Ringgold said.
"Our Prime Minister and Armed Forces Council disagree," Vance said.
Ringgold clenched her jaw, trying to withhold the heat rising through her core. "You've been hit by 1 attack, and your entire country cowers."
"All due respect, you brought these beasts on us," Vance said. "Now you want us to abandon our homeland to help you fight them."
Ringgold took a breath. As angry as she was, he was right. The variants were a product of the United States government. "I understand you've been hit hard," she said. "We've endured battle after battle,
and we've learned more than these past weeks about the enemy that will help us defeat them, but we can only do that by striking our enemy down together, not by hiding behind walls.
Cornelius nodded.
The president is absolutely right. You have to tell your council and the PM that they need to send the reinforcements they promised. Mexico is fulfilling their oath. Why can't Canada?
I'm sorry, Vance said. We've sent what we can spare. If you want me and my people to pack up and go home, we will. You saw their faces. They don't want to defend some foreign land while their wives and husbands and children and parents are back up north, unsure if they're going to make it another day.
I don't believe this, Ringgold said.
I really am sorry, but this is out of my hands, Vance said. Remember, you don't fight with the army you want. You fight with the one you have. That's what we're doing. And that's what you'll have to do as well.
Ringgold fumed at the last-minute change, but she understood Canada's perspective. She should have seen this coming. Cornelius, if we identify a target, does this change our tentative plans to destroy the Prophet?
It does, he said. We'll have to consult with General Souza again, but by my rough estimates, any concerted attack, regardless of the Prophet's location, will require at least another 500 troops to make up for what the Canadians aren't sending.
He shot Vance a look filled with daggers. Ringgold knew that 500 troops could make or break their eventual assault. They needed the total number of armed forces properly trained and equipped for an all-out offensive. But she still regretted the solution that came to mind, hoping she would not come to regret it.
General, you've been working closely with Captain Beckham to train our newest recruits, Ringgold said. How soon before you believe they'll be prepared for an offensive strike?
Cornelius was a staunch, confident man, but even he squirmed.
A few of their units have already seen action when we sent them to help reinforce Outpost Houston. They'll be the best equipped in any offensive maneuvers. I can reassign them immediately and focus their training on offensive instead of defensive tactics.
Do it, Ringgold said. We might not have long. The final battle is coming, and we need every able-bodied person left to fight it.
Azrael savored the smell of blood and antiseptic chemicals. This lab had kicked off his empire from a single follower to an army on the verge of a decisive victory. Past rows of laboratory equipment was a space that Azrael had personally helped design. The room used to be a special sterile environment suited for animal experience. Now it had been adapted for humans. It was here in this very room where he had created VX-102 and started his initial human trials. The formerly white walls were covered in a wallpaper of red tendrils from his organic communication network, another testament to the technological achievements he had accomplished with the help of his scientist cohort. Most of them had seen early on the success of VX-102, and they had chosen to elevate themselves to the status of scions, like himself. He welcomed them into his fold. Others who were not as mentally fit maintained their frail human bodies. The delicate, skinny fingers of humans were an abhorrent necessity to work with sensitive laboratory equipment, like some of the microscopes and analytical chemistry instrumentation that had been designed for their unevolved bodies. Fortunately, the scion's clawed fingers were much better at other tasks, especially the ones that Azrael cherished, like the one he was about to help with now. Sporadic screams of horror and pained groans echoed from the test specimens behind the various partitions, all isolated by plastic curtains. The buzz of surgical saws cutting through bone and the slurp of organs sliding from bodies into metal pans was music to Azrael's ears. He peeled back a plastic blood-spattered curtain to reveal his faithful old Dr. Murphy working over a humanoid body. The wrinkled old man held surgical tools and prepared to replace some of the patient's organs with transplants from a dead variant.
"Is this him?" Azrael asked.
"Yes, this is the one we recovered from Katahdin," Murphy replied. "The latest version of VX-102 has worked extraordinarily fast in him. I believe that with these final surgeries, he'll be complete."
"And his brain?"
"Fully intact, Prophet," the doctor said. "When he hasn't passed out from the pain, he can talk coherently. He's very, very angry about something.
although it usually doesn't take long for the pain to make him pass out again during my operations. Azrael traced his own clawed fingers over the long claws jutting from the patient's fingers.
Their transplants from Varian donors are truly improving the development of the Scions.
Yes, you made a wise decision adopting this practice, Murphy said. Not only do our patients immediately get the benefit of some of the physical attributes of the Scions, but the resulting inflammation and irritation from the surgeries help to activate the body's healing response. All the resulting signaling cascades accelerate the VX-102 activity and enhance the epigenetic changes. Azrael narrowed his eyes and used a claw to pull down the doctor's mask to reveal the man's lips. The doctor trembled.
You do not need to explain the science to me, Azrael said. I invented it. I know precisely what it does.
The man bowed. Yes, of course, Prophet. How foolish of me to assume otherwise.
How long until he's complete?
You will need at least 3 more days, and more for recovery.
You have 2, Azrael said. He will recover just fine.
The Prophet left Murphy's operating area and moved into another nearby OR. There, a single woman was strung up, red vines squirming into her nostrils, ear canals, and throat. She had let out a whimper when she saw him.
Please, help,
she managed to choke out.
I'm about to, Azrael said. You have been chosen.
He glanced at a surgical tray beside where the woman was suspended. Everything had already been prepped by his assistants as instructed. The only thing he needed was the donor variant organs, which were waiting on ice inside a cooler near the surgical tray.
Chosen?
She said, coughing.
Chosen for...
Azrael didn't give her a chance to finish her words. He swiped at her abdomen with his claw. This was something human fingers definitely could not do. He relished the woman's scream. Her face went white, and she squirmed a few moments before she passed out. That was quicker than he would have liked. He began the tedious process of placing hemostats over severed vessels so she wouldn't bleed to death. His preparations and the red tendrils roping through her body would keep her alive as he cut out a few of her organs to replace with the donor variant organs his people had harvested. After an hour of work, the curtains to his surgical room were peeled back.
Prophet, a rasping voice came. You told me to meet you here, yes?
Azrael didn't have to turn his attention away from his patient to know who it was. He had told the monster to meet him here while he worked.
Yes, Elijah, I have a task for you.
I stand ready, Master.
The general has failed me in Canada, Azrael said, trying hard not to crush the woman's intestines in anger as he extracted them.
He finished pulling out a rope, snapped it in half, and flung it onto a metal pan.
Team Ghost escaped.
Shall I pursue them? Elijah asked.
No.
Azrael licked the blood off his claws and turned to Elijah. The Scion was larger than most, with bulging muscles pressing against the fabric of his dark clothes. He wore a ragged cape, and in one set of claws he carried the front half of a human skull that he had fashioned into a mask. He was one of Azrael's first creations, a faithful servant, and had chosen the name Elijah after his rebirth. Azrael picked up a small electric device from his surgical tray.
Do you know what this is?
Elijah shook his head.
It's a GPS chip.
Azrael held the dime-sized device between his claws, rotating it to reflect the light.
The flexible microelectric arrays hanging off it harvest energy from the body to power it. This device helps me keep track of the faithful.
He went back to the human woman. After cutting into her bicep, he sutured the device to the inside of her flesh and connected the array to her muscle.
I have allies tracking our quarry up north, thanks to a device like this in one of our escaped Scions,
Azrael said.
So you will understand now why I'm less concerned about where these people go. We will always find them, so long as they have the tracked Scion with them.
Then what do you need from me?
I have different plans for you, Azrael said.
He finished suturing the woman's bicep and turned toward her guts again. All this surgery was making him hungry, and he caught himself salivating.
I live to serve, Elijah said.
You live because you serve.
The woman started to wake, her eyelids fluttering. She groaned, blood dribbling down her open abdomen.
What? What?
She started to murmur. She twisted her head enough against the tendrils holding her in place to see her stomach. Her mouth opened, and she let out a muffled scream. This time, the pain wasn't enough to make her pass out.
You are almost there, Azrael said.
He placed a claw on her lips, and she writhed.
Patience.
She thrashed against the vines holding her into place, moving enough that Azrael couldn't continue the surgery. No matter, it was time for him to eat anyway. He picked up the length of intestine he had removed from her.
Do you recognize this?
He held it up so she could see. Her eyes bulged. He took a bite of it, letting blood trickle over his chin.
You are delicious.
She finally fainted again, and he finished his meal, throwing a scrap to Elijah. The scion hungrily stuffed it into his mouth.
I'm growing tired of these heretics, Azrael said. It takes too long to turn a person like her into a magnificent scion like you.
Yes, yes, Elijah said.
Unfortunately, we have not located the humans who have infiltrated our network. They have built too many safeguards for our faithful to get past. I've been told it could take weeks to locate the humans. I fear that if we wait too long, they will regroup. And we have heard rumors that they have sought the assistance of other nations.
They will fail, Master. We will stop them.
Indeed, we will.
Azrael began suturing the woman's abdomen together again.
I want the rest of the Allied States crushed before we have to deal with too many other nations of heretics.
Azrael looped in the last suture and turned toward Elijah.
What do you propose, Prophet? Elijah asked.
We have the advantage, Azrael said. The humans don't know we're aware of their activities infiltrating our communication network. It's time that we use this against them. Instead of laboring to root out the heretics, we will bring them to us.
And then we will defeat them.
Azrael turned and traced a claw along the neck of the patient, watching her suture-covered chest rise and fall as she breathed slowly.
Then you will get your chance to bring in Team Ghost, Beckham, and all the rest of these traitorous bastards.
How, Prophet?
It's easy. Just tell them exactly what they want to hear.
Nine. Strapped to a chair in the parking garage outside a variant tunnel, Kate's head filled with 1,000 pained voices crying out to be free. Men, women, children, all prisoners of the variants, imprisoned in the webbing network. She wished she could send them some words of reassurance. But a single moment of weakness would ruin all her efforts. If she so much as sent them a single message, the masterminds would know she was a spy in their midst. She had to drown out their screams of agony and pleas for help. The only way to help these people was to zero in on what really mattered. Finding the Prophet, finding where the new gods were, and sabotage any incoming attacks. She had already missed the attack on Banff and the monster's communications regarding the scouts outside Houston. The longer she remained hooked up to the network filtering through the messages, the more her head throbbed. Cold sweat dripped over her flesh, and she trembled as she listened to the terrified voices of people hooked up to the vines around the country, their bodies wasting away to feed the spreading network.
Help!
Mom? Mom, where are you?
I can't breathe. I can't.
The voices overwhelmed her. She could hardly stand it.
Feed me. Feed. Food. Kill it. It threatens us. Heretics. Attack the camp. Kill the humans. Bring them to us.
Nothing out of the ordinary. She tried to keep her mind focused, but the human voices won out again. Her muscles contracted and her skull flared with pain. Suddenly, all the voices disappeared. She blinked, her blurred vision clearing to Ron standing above her.
Kate? You with me?
He asked, gingerly touching her shoulder.
Yeah. How long have I been?
A few hours.
Felt like days.
Leslie just finished up a chromatography experiment upstairs. Maybe it would be a good time for you two to swap. Kate straightened in the chair. A few soldiers guarding the parking garage glanced at her, worry clear in their expression. She twisted to see Sammy at the computer behind her.
Was it that bad?
Kate asked.
You were screaming,
Sammy said, twisting one of her dreadlocks.
You sure you're okay?
Kate massaged her temples.
I need a break. Ron, you're right. Where's Leslie?
We just sent for her, Sammy said. She walked over and handed Kate a towel for the sweat.
Thanks, Kate said.
She felt a little embarrassed to have her assistants treating her so gently, but she couldn't let pride get in her way.
I can learn how to do this too, so it's not just Leslie and you,
Ron said.
We'll see.
Footsteps soon echoed down the stairs and Leslie appeared.
I'm ready to go, she said, and I've got the last bits of data processing upstairs for you. Took me nearly the entire day to get it ready.
Give me the rundown, Kate said.
Figuring out what was in the grenade was relatively easy. It took me a few hours to run through the basic battery of biological agent assessments, but since we knew it was bacteria, that made it easier.
Kate braced herself.
It isn't a new variation of airborne VX-99, is it?
No.
Actually, it contained anthrax spores.
Were they genetically modified?
Not according to the gene sequencing.
There's something else this tells us, Kate said.
What's that?
Anthrax isn't hard to grow or distribute, but before the war, existing strains in the United States were tightly guarded, she said. Only a few national labs had access for testing and research purposes. Maybe that's another connection we can exploit.
I can compile a list of all those laboratories and institutions, Ron said.
This might be a long shot, but we already know that the person or people responsible for the new gods had access to several DARPA technologies. The high concentrations of activity in those former research labs in Denver and Seattle proved that.
But those labs only housed part of the research for the microelectric arrays and the neural programming technology for the webbing network.
Exactly. And while Seattle turned out to be a site of Chimera research, there was no sign of the prophet there. Based on the presence of anthrax in that grenade and all the crazy biological horrors like the bats, masterminds, network, and chimeras, we need to be focusing on labs related to biodefense.
We're looking for one sick former government biologist behind all this, aren't we?
Sammy said.
I wouldn't be surprised.
It was a rogue military officer who led to the initial VX-99 outbreak, and with the number of technologies the new gods have used, it wouldn't surprise me to find out that some traitorous Department of Defense scientist or an entire research group is behind all this.
But when we found out about Denver and Seattle, how would we have missed this place when we were tracking all that communication activity over the network?
Ron asked. Sammy answered for Kate.
Firewalls, encrypted comms. Think basic cybersecurity, except adapted for a biological network. Whoever this prophet is, he keeps proving himself smarter than we ever anticipated. If he was previously involved in national security, the guy would know how to protect his digital and physical footprint.
Sammy, I want you to dig a little deeper in the network with Leslie, Kate said. See if you can find any dark corners of the network that might be protected by these firewalls. We need to redouble our search efforts.
I'll get started now, Sammy said.
Kate turned to Leslie.
How about the biopsied chimera tissues?
The last of the chromatography and PCR runs were just finishing when I came down. Should be ready for you in less than half an hour.
Thank you, Kate said.
Anything else you need from me now?
Tap into the network when you feel up to it.
I'm ready. Leslie eagerly took the seat where Kate had been as Ron prepared the webbing for her to integrate with. Once she was in the chair, Ron glanced at his wristwatch.
She can probably withstand listening for a good 4 or 5 hours, Ron said. I can join you up in the lab once we know Leslie's communication to the network is stable.
Do it, Kate said. She headed straight to the lab. A few of the chromatography machines were still humming and clicking as the pumps and injectors siphoned various samples through their lines. Ron joined her a few minutes later, and they reviewed the data Leslie had told them about. By then, the last of the chromatography runs had finished, which would give them some insight into the properties of the compounds they had identified in the Chimera's tissues. I want to cross-reference every active molecule and chemical compound we find in the biopsy tissues with a known list of pharmaceuticals and biological agents, Kate said. If you find any matches, let me know. We're going to see if any suspicious compounds help us pinpoint a research group responsible for developing them, right? You've got it, Kate said. She scrolled through the analytical results on the computer. Any matches might tell us the original companies or institutions where these compounds were produced. I'm on it, Ron said. They each worked at computers side by side, poring over the results. It took several hours for the automated database search to return their queries. While Kate found matches for a few of the molecules, she discovered several with no known matches. Ron came up with a similar list. Doesn't look like anything we've seen before, he said. There's no way to tell where they came from. Kate sighed. I did find something interesting. See what you think. I'm all ears, Ron said, turning away from his computer. Kate pointed to a pair of molecules on her screen. The long chain of lines and angles representing bonds between atoms was nearly indistinguishable between the two molecules at first glance. But Kate pointed to a smaller section toward the right end of the chain. The first molecule you see is one of the active components in VX-99, Kate said. It confers many of the epigenetic changes that lead to the aggressive nature of the variants. Following? In this second sample, the one we extracted from the Chimera, the last chain of molecules is different, Kate said. It's impossible to say exactly what it does without extensive computational modeling and cellular studies. But you think that it could be enough to change the molecule's function so it doesn't alter the neurological activity of the variants? It's all a theory, but bottom line, yes. She could tell from Ron's expression that a light had gone off in his head. What you're telling me is that someone modified VX-99, he said. This version turns people into actual super soldiers without destroying their intellect. Kate didn't want to believe it, but it was hard to deny. This has to be someone who had access to the original VX-99 studies and samples, she said. Someone with intimate government connections. Kate tapped on the keyboard, clicking through to another molecule. There are a couple of compounds that look like they were adapted from other government projects. They have a sub-90% similarity match, but it's certainly enough to connect a few dots, she continued. Like what? This one. Kate pointed to her screen. It looks similar to an active compound DARPA was working on that can be used in cell targeting for drug delivery. It homes in on very specific cell types, which means that this mysterious VX-99 variant could act much faster on its target. VX-99 already turned people into monsters in days. Expediting targeting efficiency could decrease the dosage needed in a host while increasing the targeted signaling pathways. So a person would change in less than a couple days? With the right conditions, the first changes would be nearly immediate. Good God, Ron said. He pushed away from his computer, slouching in his seat. This is worse than a nightmare. There must be some more commonalities we can identify to find out who is responsible. Ron swiveled his monitor back to face him. I know you're good with the molecular data, but I'm more of a big-picture researcher. We already have tons of data from your past research on what VX-99 does to a human to turn them into a variant, including anatomical studies. But we don't have that kind of data for chimeras. You're right. That could be just as helpful. Tell Jacobs we need a full workshop on that chimera they captured. MRI, CT, whatever they got. I want to know what that thing looks like under its skin. Ron picked up their radio to make the call. No. Better to keep this one quiet, Kate said. Just in case anyone's listening who shouldn't be. Yes, of course. He started to head toward the door. Wait, she said. Ron looked back. The last report we got back from Ghost said they have a chimera in their custody, too. See if we can get the same data from the Canadians. The more, the better. Ron disappeared into the hall to relay the message, and Kate continued working for another 30 minutes trying to fit the pieces of this scientific puzzle together. She was certain that the spider web of connections they were making would lead to a clue. The radio on the lab bench crackled. Dr. Lovato, are you there? It was Sammy. Her voice was tinged with worry. Kate grabbed the radio. What's going on? We intercepted something. Leslie is headed in your direction right now. A minute later, someone pounded on the door. Kate opened it to let Leslie in. The woman's face was red. We heard it. We finally heard it. Heard what? Leslie took a deep breath. They're in Las Vegas. Who? The collaborators? Another mastermind? The prophet. The new gods, everything. They're headquartered in Las Vegas. Kate nearly stumbled backward. You're sure? Leslie nodded. Sammy recorded the transmission. We're positive. This could be it, Kate said. But you can't tell anyone. We cannot let this get out. She hung up her lab coat and started to open the door. Go find Ron and tell him and Sammy to wait for me at the variant tunnels. Where are you going? Leslie asked. I need to tell Reed, she said. And the president. Another long day in Calgary had passed without incident. The sound of water dripping echoed through the warehouse far outside the city limits. Banks of sodium lights hung overhead, and pipes ran along the ceiling. Team Spearhead was taking their turn guarding the place, while Dohai and Ace watched Corin. But that was not why Fitz had trouble finding some shut-eye.
Can't get a lick of sleep? Ace asked, his face ripe with bruises and exhaustion.
Fitz sat up against a crate.
Impossible. Worried about an attack on Calgary? Dohai asked.
Fitz gazed over at Corin, who had somehow managed to nod off. The Chimera was in the corner of the warehouse, chained and shackled to a bolt in the concrete floor about 20 yards away from them. That was a result of the Canadians' orders when they had arrived, before the medics had taken General Kamer elsewhere into the outpost for medical treatment with Sergeant Prince. They had left Spearhead and Ghost to watch Corin out here.
Worried about him, Fitz said, gesturing toward the Chimera. He got us out of Seattle and saved Kamer. I'm worried the Canadians are going to kill him.
Ace flicked a cockroach crawling toward him.
Yep, and it's a damn shame. I think the guy's being truthful with us, even if he is uglier than my ass. The Canadians are right to be suspicious, Dohai said, voice calm. What, you think he actually called the enemy in? Ace asked, bushy gray brow raised. No, I just think there's something we're missing. I don't believe in coincidences. If you figure out how they tracked him, or us, I'm all ears, Fitz said. Maybe a GPS, Ace suggested. We didn't find anything on his clothes or on his body, Fitz said. They might have forced one of those devices down his throat or something, Ace said. No, Dohai said. The only GPS trackers small enough to implant in a person or ingest have batteries that don't last more than a couple days at max, especially with the power required to transmit a signal from Banff to Seattle.
Ace opened his mouth to speak, but the sounds of footsteps clattering toward them interrupted him. Fitz scrambled to stand on his blades, and the other two followed suit. Corin jolted awake. The steps echoed in the wide space until Nielsen appeared with Toussaint and Doherty. Behind them were another 10 men. All military. A few gasped when they saw Corin. Others looked terrified, and Fitz noticed several lift their rifles slightly like they were ready to shoot Corin.